way that
I know
they...
you're into the cannibals. In a curious way, not in a...
I am into the cannibals.
Hello, I'm Akshi.
And I'm Shayna, and you're listening to Unpacking the Eerie. Over the course of our friendship, we quickly learned that we had very specific overlapping interests in true crime, the occult,
conspiracy theories, and other unknowns, and also
intergenerational and historical trauma,
social, racial, gender, and economic justice, psychology, humor,
and obviously lots of podcasts. After many conversations, we thought the intersections of all of these things would be prime content for a podcast we've always wanted but have never found. This is that podcast. Before we get started, we want to offer a content warning. In this episode, we're going to be mentioning violence against sex workers, domestic violence, sexual violence, and child abuse.
Okay. Well, here we are.
Here we are. Hello, everybody.
Once again, we are recording on holiday.
Mm-hmm.
It's Christmas.
It's Christmas, which Akshi has a gift for you.
Mm-hmm. It was a gift for myself, too, doing the research.
I'm excited. It'll be a gift for me as well.
Yeah, I think we'll all learn some stuff and have some new perspectives.
All about that. So first, we wanted to update on Patreon. We have 7 patrons total now, which is so exciting. Thank you so much.
And if this gives you some more motivation to become a patron, once we get to 10, we're going to think of getting merch.
Yes, we definitely need a minimum to consider getting merch because it is an extra percentage off of what we, you know.
Already have a fee, so.
There's so many fees, you know?
Yep, just like Uber Eats.
Oh my gosh, yes. That's what it's like.
Yep.
Yeah, if you're so compelled, true crime tippers, haha, start at $2 a month. So think of it as like... All of those bar tips that you're not spending right now could be like a tip for each show that comes out.
Yep.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
We wanted to give a shout out to Clifton, to Jill, and to Victoria and Jerry. Jerry is our first ghosty giver, which when I say it out loud sounds so ridiculous.
I love it, though.
But it's cute. It's cute. I'm here for it. To get everyone oriented, if you don't know what Patreon is, because someone asked me what Patreon was. Patreon is a platform for creators to build like a network of support, but also get a little extra money for their work. It's like a lot of different artists and podcast creators and YouTubers and what have you on this.
Writers, yeah.
Yeah. And each tier gives you different benefits. We don't have a ton of benefits at the moment except for our like
because we don't really have the time to make so a lot of extra content. So
right. That's not something we
probably after we graduate we will though. So
that's true. That's a whole new world.
Yep.
So there's 2 tiers. There's the True Crime Tippers, which starts at $2 a month, and then Ghosty Givers starts at $20 a month, but 50% of all of that money will go to a nonprofit or mutual aid effort tackling issues we talk about in our episodes. And so our very first beneficiary is going to be the Person of Color Sex Worker Outreach Project. For context, in our second episode, if you listened to it, you may remember that we talked about Gary Ridgway, aka the Green River Killer. We dug into how white privilege, misogyny, and violence against women and girls in the sex trade allowed the Green River Killer to get away with murdering sex workers and homeless girls for over 20 years up and down the Pacific Northwest. And most of those murders took place in the south end of Seattle. So this winter, between now and March 2021, the Ghosty Giver beneficiary will be, as mentioned, POC Sex Workers Outreach Project. They are a BIPOC-led chapter of the National Sex Workers Outreach Project, who emerged as a response to the lack of support for specifically Black and other sex workers of color in the Seattle area. Right now, their main focus is direct outreach to street-based sex workers via the Greenlight Project, which is a peer-to-peer initiative. And a long-term goal is to empower BIPOC in the sex trade by diffusing power from central leadership and putting it back into the hands of the community. So we're very excited.
That's awesome.
Yeah, super cool. So thank you, Jerry, for being our first Ghosty Giver.
Thank you, Jerry.
The donation money will be supporting BIPOC sex workers in the area where Gary was most prolific. So,
okay.
I think that's all I had.
Well, just to kick off this episode, I wanted to do a little research about Christmas since we're recording on Christmas. And I found this great article on this website called The Good Men Project, which does a lot of work on redefining what masculinity is, and they post a lot of really cool articles both related to that but also related to other topics. And I read an article on the Good Men Project, which we'll link in our sources, called Exposing Christian Imperialism, and I learned about something called Christian cultural imperialism or hegemony, which is defined as promotion of the larger Christian culture celebrations, values, and beliefs, and it's the institutionalization of a Christian norm or standard. And so between the end of October and January, people start saying the phrases happy holidays, and they're referring to what we talked about last episode, which is Thanksgiving, and also Christmas and New Year's that come up. We already talked about why Thanksgiving is fucked our last episode, so I'm not going to go back into that. But, you know, there's holidays that occur during this time that are not Christmas. For example, Hanukkah, also known as the Festival of Lights, which is an 8-day Jewish holiday observing the rededication of the second Holy Jewish Temple in Jerusalem in 3593 on the Jewish calendar, 167 BCE on the Gregorian calendar. Hanukkah begins on sundown on the 25th of Kislev on the Jewish calendar, which falls anywhere between late November and late December on the Christian Gregorian calendar. There's also Kwanzaa, which was created by Maulana Karenga and first celebrated in 1966, and it honors the African heritage and culture. It is commemorated annually between December 26th and January 1st on the Gregorian calendar, and the name was drawn from the Swahili phrase Matunda ya Kwanzaa, meaning first fruits of the harvest. Celebrants light candles each night on candelabras called kinaras. However, there's also other holidays that occur at different points of the year that are not celebrated to the extent that Christmas is at this point of the year all around the world. So we can't be including Hindus, Jains, Sikhs, and Muslims and several other religious groups during this time because they don't have any holidays occurring at this time. So let's consider, like, when we say happy holidays, who that's actually for. This article argues that happy holidays is actually coded language for Merry Christmas and Happy New Year, and tries to make it more inclusive when actually, you know, there's a lot of holidays that occur at different points of the year, and we're not saying happy holidays at that point. So not only is it coded language for Merry Christmas and Happy New Year, it's also coded language for Thanksgiving. So, yeah. So maybe just say Merry Christmas to the people who want to hear it. I've been thinking about that a lot because everyone's been saying happy holidays this past couple of days. Mm-hmm. Most non-Christian major holidays are not celebrated during this time. Like, how many people in the U.S. care about or are familiar with non-Christian holidays that are celebrated at other times of the year, or also non-Christian holidays that fall around the same time? 26% of U.S. Americans are also atheists, agnostic, or non-believers. Though the celebrations of Christmas between November and December are presented as secular, there are still reminders of Christian symbols in Christianity. So this is a quote from the article. The effect of the so-called secularization of religion, in fact, not only fortifies, but indeed strengthens Christian privilege by perpetuating Christian hegemony in such a way as to avoid its detection as religion or to circumvent constitutional requirements for the separation of religion and government. Christian dominance, therefore, is maintained by its relative invisibility, and with this invisibility, privilege is neither analyzed nor scrutinized, neither interrogated nor confronted. So what it's trying to say is, like, this dominance is perceived as unremarkable or normal, and so when anyone poses a challenge or attempts to reveal its religious significance, those in the dominant group brand them as subversive or sacrilegious or war against Christmassers. Do you have any thoughts about that?
I mean, yeah, it's so true, and I think I don't think we think about it at all.
We don't think about it at all.
Because there's like a newer consciousness around white privilege. When I say newer, I mean more widely recognized. Not that people haven't been talking about it for
ever.
And people are like, oh yeah, privilege is not having to notice that it's a thing. And people can understand that about whiteness, but I don't know that a lot of people consider it from a religious standpoint, which is, I mean, Christian supremacy is a product of white supremacy.
Yep.
And we're just like in it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've always celebrated Christmas, but my mom was not Christian.
Mm-hmm.
Like so many people just like by default celebrate Christmas because it's expected of people
because
to
of
do.
The secularization of Christmas. And, you know, they're not even sure that Christmas is Jesus' birthday.
No. They say it's, we talked about this last episode, they say it was the 29th of February, which Richard Ramirez's birthday.
Yeah.
And both of them were Pisces.
Oh, my gosh. So I have some examples of how Christian cultural imperialism is present in the holiday season. Constant and prolonged promotion of Christmas music in public spaces, radio, Christmas specials on TV, Netflix, Christmas decorations that are paid for by taxpayers in public spaces. This also happens in Singapore. We have Christmas, a whole Christmas season after Diwali's done. Christian holiday decorations in holiday stores. President and First Lady lighting a Christmas tree. Can you think of any more examples, Shayna? I know that there's like a ton.
I mean, I think you named the basic ones.
The basic ones.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's everywhere. I mean, right down my street, there's a little candy cane lane to see people's houses. What I didn't even realize until I was doing this research is our fucking calendar is also based on the birth of Jesus. The year, like this year, 2020, is calculated with reference to the birth of Jesus. And it's the beginning of the Christian millennium.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Right.
In the Jewish calendar, we're in year 5,781. And in the Chinese calendar, we're in year 4,718. And I know that other New Years fall at, like, different points of the year. It's not January 1st. Most of the time, it changes from year to year because it's based on either the position of the moon or the position of other planets. So I know that the Tamil New Year falls around April every year, and that's similar to other cultures in India and South Asia and East Asia as well. I wanted to go into a little bit about the Tamil calendar because I'm Tamil and, like, my grandma always talks to me about it. So it follows a 60-year cycle, which is very ancient, and it's observed by most traditional calendars in South Asia and also China. According to popular belief, it's related to the five revolutions of Jupiter around the sun. Currently in yogic astronomy, we are in what is known as the Kali Yuga 5122, part of the Hindu lunar calendar. In the Islamic calendar, we're in 1442 AH, and this is based on the moon and based on astronomy, unlike the Christian Gregorian calendar. And then because you're part Korean, I also looked up when the Korean New Year is.
Wow.
And in 2021, it's on February 12th, and it also changes every year. And it lasts 3 days and occurs on either the second or the third new moon after the winter solstice. So I think it's kind of cool how these, like, the other New Years are based around kind of the planetary and moon alignments.
Yeah.
And how that's, like, very similar across religions and cultures too. Basically what I'm trying to say with all this information, I'm not saying don't celebrate Christmas. I'm talking about how, like, systemic structures and how Christian privilege and hegemony is promoted not just in the U.S., but across the world as well as something that's secular and, like, quote-unquote normal. Other cultural holidays and other religious holidays are not afforded the same kind of privilege. And actually, people from other religions, again, just depending on where you are, experience discrimination based on celebrating the holidays that they want to celebrate. So I'm going to quote from this article again. This person says, "I argue that the systemic structures themselves promote Christian imperialism and hegemony, in which individuals are often unwilling and even unknowing conspirators. Wishing people happy holidays simply glosses over the Christian assumptions inherent during this time of year. Wishing people happy holidays in December can be very nice and well-intentioned, but if you want to be sensitive and inclusive while acknowledging others' cultures, why not wish people of other faiths happy holidays during their holidays that are actually important? So during, like, Diwali and Eid and Chinese New Year and, you know, any other holiday that occurs. Like, maybe just find out what holidays your friends and family members actually do celebrate. And if they don't celebrate any holidays, be mindful of that fact too, and don't just, like, rope them into it because everyone else is doing it. Many people say that saying happy holidays is intended to promote intercultural awareness, but the author of this article, and I would agree with them, argues that it's the exact opposite and kind of invisibilizes what we're actually talking about when we say happy holidays in, like, November and December. We're talking about Thanksgiving and we're talking about Christmas. We're talking about Christian New Year. Like, I freaking love New Year's and I love celebrating New Year's, but, you know, we're also celebrating New Year's on the Gregorian calendar, which is based on the birth of Jesus. I'm going to do one last quote from this article. "While the intent may certainly be well-meaning and heartfelt, the impact is often exactly the opposite. The concept of oppression constitutes more than the cruel and repressive actions of individuals. It involves an overarching system of differentials of social power and privilege exercised by dominant groups over subordinated groups, based on ascribed social identities and reinforced by unequal social group status. Unpacking the knapsack of privilege, whether it be Christian, white, male, heterosexual, owning class, temporarily able-bodied, English speakers, and others, is to become aware of and to develop a critical consciousness of its existence and to recognize how it affects the daily lives of both those with and those without this privilege." So fantastic. That's what I have. And I wanted to say one more thing about Christmas, or just kind of highlight something that I saw this morning. So this morning I was scrolling on Instagram and one of the accounts that I follow called Melanated Social Work posted about some resistance that occurred on Christmas. And so I just wanted to read the caption of this post and kind of uplift something really cool that happened on a Christmas a long time ago. "The Christmas season gave way to the largest slave rebellion in the history of the British Caribbean, known as the Christmas Rebellion or the Baptist War. During 10 days in late December 1831 into January 1832, nearly 60,000 slaves, about 20% of the enslaved population of 300,000, led by the Black Baptist preacher Samuel Sharp, went on strike and rebelled against plantation owners, demanding freedom and higher wages. According to Michael Creighton's Testing the Chains, Resisting Slavery in the British West Indies, about 500 slaves were brutally killed by the end of the Christmas Rebellion, which Creighton argues accelerated the process of emancipation in the British Caribbean."
Wow.
Yeah.
How come we don't learn
We don't learn about this stuff?
I'm always baffled by how much history just was not taught.
Swept under the rug.
Oh, man.
Well, are we ready to start talking about some dark shit?
Yes, I am ready to talk
about
some dark
shit. So this is our final and third episode in the Hotel Cecil series. And I'm just going to start.
It's wild as fuck.
It is wild as fuck. In December of 1974, a naked corpse was found by two hunters in Ewersbach, now known as Dietzholzel. There's going to be a lot of German words here that I'm definitely going to fuck up, so I apologize. Germany. She had been beaten badly with a blunt instrument and strangled to death with her own bra. In 1976, 2 years later, Johann Jack Unterweger was convicted for this crime, the murder of 18-year-old Margaret Schaefer. Him and his girlfriend at the time, Barbara Schulz, had driven from Frankfurt to Ebersbach with a plan to rob Barbara's parents because they needed money. On their way there, though, Barbara noticed her friend Margaret walking down the street, and they decided to scam her instead. So they convinced Margaret to get in the car with them, and they drove around and disoriented her before Jack assaulted Margaret in the car with Barbara's belt. They tried to get money from her, but she only had very little on her. And so she told them, let me take you to my parents' house and I'll give you the key. And so they actually went to her parents' house, stole money from Margaret's parents' house as well. And then Jack drove them out of town stating to Barbara that Margaret, quote, needed to disappear. When they got out of town, he forced her to undress and physically assaulted her when she refused to do so. Both Jack and Barbara stripped her naked before Jack disappeared into the woods with Margaret alone.
When I listened to this story and I was like, Barbara, you're a gender traitor.
Yep. Like, I wonder what was going through her head, whether she was like scared, whether she'd seen this behavior from him before. Because this is his first, quote, murder that was known of. But mm-hmm. I suspect that he'd done he had done shitty stuff before, which I'll get into. But yeah.
I'm going to be generous with my assumptions and hope that she was just very scared and it had gone further.
Because he did ask her if she wanted to come to the woods with him, and she said, no, I'm going to stay at the car. So she clearly knew that he was going to get up to some fucked up shit.
But also, what the fuck?
Yeah, but maybe she had some pick me stuff going on too, where she was like, well, he likes me, even though he hates women.
I hate that. Okay.
Yep, I hate it. So he took her into the woods alone, and here's the content warning. He then beat her with a steel rod and then strangled her with her bra, returned to the car 15 minutes later. Mm. He told Barbara, quote, there's no way she can betray us now. So in 1976, Jack was arrested in Basel, Switzerland, due to getting caught in a scheme he was working on with Barbara and another girl, Maria, to ransom money from the parents of Maria, who was a 16-year-old Austrian girl. Together with Jack and Barbara, she had also robbed a jeweler and they had ran to Switzerland. At this point, Jack had already had a history of crime and being in and out of prison. He had 16 past convictions at this point, mostly for sexually or physically assaulting sex workers. So he's one of these. A few years before this, he had actually picked up an unknown woman, offered her a ride home, and instead beat her and raped her with a steel rod. She survived and basically made a complaint about it, and this was linked back to Jack. When he was caught for like this ransom scheme in Switzerland, a connection was made between Barbara and Margaret Schaefer, and Barbara confessed to what had happened, and Jack was arrested for Margaret Schaefer's murder. He received a life sentence to this, and during his trial, he told the court that as he hit Margaret, he had a vision of his mother who abandoned him. He said that his anger towards his mother fueled his reason for beating and strangling Margaret to death. So what the fuck happened to Jack?
He reminds me a lot of Gary when mm-hmm. he says that shit. Mm-hmm. It's my mom's fault.
Ed Gein also said stuff like that too.
This is just a classic pattern of like hating your mom, absent dad. Okay, we'll get into this. This is what we know of his childhood based on his own storytelling. And I say that because he wrote it in a book.
With the purpose of publishing the book and selling it.
Right.
Yeah.
So hold on to that, I guess. Okay. So I'm going to start with giving context around the time he was born. So World War II ended in 1945, and Allied forces from the U.S., Britain, France, and the USSR remained in Germany and Austria. And the occupation lasted for about 10 years. And during this time, birth rates really spiked. And many children, specifically of U.S. soldiers, were born in Austria. So I'm going to share a little bit about his mom and what we know about his mom. So in 1950, Theresia Unterweger went to Trieste, Italy, and met a man named Jack Becker, who was a U.S. soldier. They said that during this time, many women engaged in survival sex to make ends meet post-war. That could have been the situation, that Jack was a, like, client. They also say that it could have been a fling. They don't know. He doesn't stick around, so we don't know. We don't know really anything about Jack, just that he's the father. During pregnancy, Theresia resorted to stealing to get by and then was incarcerated for fraud. And shortly after this, she gives birth. Johann Unterweger was born August 16th, 1950 in Judenburg, Austria.
A Leo.
A Leo. This is making sense. An asshole Leo.
I did try to look up his chart, but his birth time wasn't there, so there's no full chart for him.
That makes sense. Seems like there wasn't a super stable time for Theresia.
Yeah.
So he never knew his dad. What he knew about his mom was that she worked at a restaurant and bar. Sounds like she had two jobs. But Jack insists that she was also a sex worker on the side. There's no way to confirm this either. And then at 2 years old, I think Theresia wasn't in a place to care for him. And so he was taken to his grandfather, who Jack says was an abusive alcoholic. And he said that he saw his grandfather. It was a really small home that they lived in, so everything was kind of open and shared. Jack said that he would see his grandfather bring home sex workers and girlfriends and have sex in front of Jack. He also says that he lived with his aunt, who was a sex worker that people say he made up. He says, or he shared in his book, that it was the only person that was ever kind to him. Mm. And she was murdered by one of her clients.
Yeah.
And by the time he was 5 years old, he started drinking. So that's like his early childhood. And again, he says this happened, but later we learn that there's some family members or a family member that speaks out to say that this wasn't true. There's also no evidence that this aunt existed at all. So could be a both and. It could, like, a lot of these things could have happened, and he just embellished them. Because honestly, like, the story he's telling, I'm seeing parallels to other serial killers' lives.
Yeah.
And all of this would kind of make sense. But also, you know, take it with a grain of salt, because this is from Jack's book.
Yep.
After this, he jumped from...
He's not a reliable narrator.
No, he's not. No, he is not. So he jumped from foster home to foster home. And by his teens, he moved on to robbery and pimping.
He basically, from his teenage years until the point where he was arrested and received a life sentence for Margaret Schaefer's murder, he had a lot. He was in and out of prison and jail, mostly for sexually assaulting and physically assaulting sex workers. At the time that he entered prison, he was illiterate. And at his time in Stein prison, he learned how to read, and he read a lot, and he also learned how to write. And actually became a prolific writer of poetry, short stories, plays, and even a novel. Most of his work was autobiographical. His book, Endstation Zuchthaus, or Terminal Prison, actually won an Austrian Literary Prize in 1984. And his other book, Fege Fuhr, or Purgatory, became a bestseller and was made into a successful film. Here are some quotes from his book in English. I wielded my steel rod among the prostitutes of Hamburg, Munich, and Marseille. I had enemies and conquered them through my inner hatred. I guess he's talking about his enemies being his mom and his maybe aunt. He also wrote, no theme is more poetic than the death of a beautiful woman.
What the fuck? What the fuck?
Wait until this next quote to react. There is an age at which a woman must be beautiful in order to be loved. And there is an age in which a woman must be loved in order to be beautiful.
I hate him. He's horrible. Why the fuck was this a bestseller? You know what? This really speaks to the culture of Austria during this time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And like the literary elite.
Right. Like the misogyny is so blatant. It's not
so
even...
So obvious.
Oh.
But apparently this is the kind of writing that won over the quote-unquote respected, quote-unquote, literary elite and intellectual community of Vienna while he was in prison. His autobiography convinced these people that he was sensitive and, quote, went mad because he had grown up without a mother and was abused. His skill with words persuaded many of these people that he should no longer be in prison. I'm going to later highlight other people who have also written books in prison who were not offered the same luxury as Jack. And I'm just going to say it says something about who matters to society and whether their beliefs and behaviors are actually thought to be harmful to those in the elite. And he wasn't, because he targeted sex workers and he was not a threat to the status quo at all.
Right.
Austrian writers and prison reformists took up Jack's cause with the support of a literary organization called PEN, which is actually a global association of writers founded in 1921 and is still active and has centers in over 100 countries. A cool thing about PEN currently is that it currently has a program called Prison and Justice Writing Program, and it's been in existence for 40 years, and they provide free resources, mentors, and audiences for incarcerated folks. Works of Justice is an online series that they have that features content connected to this program that you can check out. So they actually have a COVID-related one called Temperature Check COVID-19 Behind Bars, which is reportage by incarcerated writers and podcast interviews of those who are currently incarcerated, mostly in the U.S.
Hmm.
Anyways, so this organization at that point of time also supported the release of Jack Unterweger from prison. Apparently, the fact that he had written two books, even though their content was questionable, was proof that he had healed.
I just really can't with all of this.
Yeah. Two Nobel Prize winners were part of this movement, and everyone was just impressed by his literary quality, whatever the fuck that means. Not only was he now this renowned author, he was also the country's, quote, most high-profile rehabilitated offender. In his youth, he'd been a thief and a pimp. At 25, he was convicted of a murder and sentence, and he passed the time in a cell by writing and taking correspondence courses on literature and narrative writing. He also began submitting children's stories to the radio, which ultimately broadcast about 50 of them. It's just wild how he's been given a platform like this as well.
I mean, he's not just publishing a book. He's, like, blowing the fuck up.
Yeah. He's, like, going viral in, like,
this is really struggling 1970s. His ego.
Mm-hmm.
I hate.
So one woman, a music teacher, and a single mother was so moved by his children's stories that she visited him in prison and later testified at his parole hearing that a man who wrote such tales was, quote, full of love.
I mean, you read me a few lines from the book and it just didn't scream full of love to me.
I guess she's talking about his children's stories, but I mean, they're still written by the same person who wrote this bullshit book.
Maybe he dulled down the misogyny for the children's books.
Yeah.
What the fuck did he write about in the children's books?
Yeah, I'm curious. I'm sure they're all in German, so.
Mm.
He also wrote a play and a volume of poetry, and in 1982, his autobiographical novel Purgatory was published. In 1988, Purgatory was presented to the public in a film adaptation, first in cinemas and then on ORF, which is of the Austrian Broadcasting Network, television. This is a quote from an LA Times article. The photo on the book cover shows the menace and dark allure that Unterweger exploited so successfully. Slender with piercing eyes, chains slung around his neck and a large prison tattoo across his bare chest. Women wanted to rescue him. Okay. Which makes me think of what you were talking about at the end of our last episode and, like, the women who are attracted to these, quote, bad boys. So while he was still in prison, he gave televised readings in the prison auditorium, which were attended by intellectuals and government officials. He was even allowed to attend the premiere of his play End Station Prison at the Vienna People's Theater. This was while he was still incarcerated.
I'm shaking my head. No one can see it, but I'm shaking my head and just...
Shayna's unimpressed.
No.
Here's another quote. This is a quote by Peter Humer, a writer and radio talk show host who is also in support of Unterweger being released from prison. Unterweger represented the great hope of intellectuals that through the verbalization of problems, you could somehow come to grips with them. We wanted to believe him very badly.
There's just, like, really no nuance here in their analysis.
Yeah.
And they're also just, like...
It's very black and white.
It's super black and white. And also just, like, reactive. But wow. This is all so fucked up.
I know, right? There's a quote from this Washington Post article about him. It says, "To the Viennese cafe intellectuals who pulled him from prison and embraced him as one of their own, Jack Unterweger was proof positive that bad boys can become good men. He was their reclamation project, their social experiment, their civilized barbarian. He was a crook who had come to terms with his own criminality, a murderer whose homicidal impulses had been channeled into the salutary act of writing. You only had to watch him on the TV talk shows, charming and natty in his double-breasted suits, to know that Jack Unterweger was a beast who had been tamed."
Ew, what the fuck?
Actually, so he was, basically there was this movement to get him out of prison.
Yeah.
And a psychiatrist during this time where they were, like, trying to assess him said that he had gone straight, sublimating his aggression through his writing, and he was witty, polite, and cool, which are all things that narcissists are.
Yeah. I'm also wondering, too, I'm thinking about Mindhunter.
Yeah, yeah.
And how, you know, a good show. They did an amazing with the casting.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing. Like, Ed Kemper is uncanny and
really
scary.
Yeah.
Ooh, we should cover Ed Kemper.
Yeah,
what a
we
piece
should.
Of work, that guy.
Yeah. Oh, I meant Ed Kemper, not Ed Gein earlier when I was talking about the mom.
Okay. Different Ed.
Yeah.
Different serial killer Ed.
Yeah.
But
Ed Kemper had tons of mommy issues.
So many, I mean, Max mommy
yeah,
issues.
Mommy issues.
Wow. Like, wow, wow. Yeah, some of you know exactly what I'm talking
yep.
about. But you know how they, I don't know how, like, close to history they're playing these two FBI guys who are part of, like, the behavioral unit.
Mm-hmm,
but you know
mm-hmm.
how they had a really hard time convincing, like, police departments that serial killers operated out of, like, a different set of motivations. Like, it's not just about primal stuff. There was this very basic understanding of what caused violence, you know, like it was a fit of rage that happened. It was about greed. It was about
passion.
Like, it was impulsive. And if it was premeditated, it was still about something that you wanted to gain. It was, like, really only conceptualized in this crime of passion kind of
way.
And then if someone acted outside of that, they were just conceptualized as, like, a solitary monster person. And so I'm wondering if, since Austria really didn't see any, like, serial killers weren't really a thing for them, or at least to their knowledge. And violent crime was pretty low from what we know.
No.
Maybe they just really didn't have an analysis at all for what they couldn't fathom that somebody like this exists and that rehabilitation wasn't possible or something.
Mm-hmm.
So they really, really wanted, I think they really, really wanted to believe that one of their citizens wasn't actually like this. And also, if this man was not white, he would not be given the same grace.
Definitely not. Definitely not.
All. Like, I really do think that they saw themselves in him.
Yeah.
And they wanted so badly for it to be true that he was no longer going to be this horrific man.
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, I digress.
So on May 23rd, 1990, after serving a 15-year sentence, which is the minimum before parole, Jack Unterweger was paroled And a prison warden stated, "We will never find a prisoner so well prepared for freedom."
They're really gassing him up.
They gassed him up. They really contributed to his freaking ego. Actually, this case is similar to an American killer turned author, Jack Henry Abbott, whose cause was taken up by a writer and activist, Norman Mailer. And shortly after he was released, he killed again. And Mailer said in response to this, "Culture is worth a little risk." And I wrote, "These white men, honestly."
For real.
Who's the risk, though? You're not facing the risk.
No, they are the risk.
Yeah.
They're the risk.
So, John Leake is the author of Entering Hades, The Double Life of a Serial Killer, and he's an American translator who lived in Vienna, and states that Jack's memoir was fiction and that he fabricated a lot of the stories because his stories were challenged by his relatives. After he was released, he was in heavy demand for bookstore readings, literary parties, and talk shows. Artistic Vienna congratulated itself on its open-mindedness. And I wrote, "So reforming a killer is more important and open-minded than accepting sex work as a profession and actually making sure sex workers are well taken care of and not assaulted and murdered on the regular?" And from my perspective, there's a lot of red flags around Jack just from reading his work. He's obsessed with death. One of his poems read, "You still seem strange and distant and lively, death, but one day you will be close and full of flames. Come, lover, I am there. Take me, I am yours." And as I mentioned before, there was red flags in his misogynistic writing in those quotes that I said earlier about, you know, no theme is more poetic than the death of a beautiful woman. Also, another red flag, those who were close to him were actually very skeptical. Willie Hengstler, the filmmaker who directed Purgatory, said, "Jack doesn't like literature. Jack doesn't like writers. Jack doesn't like anything. Jack only likes Jack."
Succinct and probably very true.
Yep. And he made his movie, so he probably spent a bunch of time with him. And even his lawyer said he was a very difficult person to understand. To have a conversation with him was hard. I think he wasn't normal. There's a lot of red flags when Jack was released from prison. Given all of that, in the year in which he was released, he had published two novels, produced two plays, with financial help from the cultural ministry.
Unreal.
Going back to something else. 6 months after his release, very curiously, sex workers in Austria began to go missing and were found murdered by strangulation.
Surprise.
Surprise, surprise.
I'm not surprised. We should probably be clear about our stance on, like,
prisons
and,
yeah,
rehabilitation. Like,
I'm for that.
Like, focusing on, like, restorative and transformative justice models, and also
that's not what happened here.
That's not what happened here. Like, what does accountability actually look like?
Yeah.
Whatever that actually looks like did not happen with Jack.
We're not going to go into that this episode, but I'm sure we will in future episodes on what restorative and transformative justice can look like for serial murderers and serial sex offenders. There honestly isn't much right now for these people, but in my head, I think it's more about addressing the root causes of harm before it gets to this point than, like, addressing it afterwards, because I don't think we're there yet.
Yeah, well, and that's the thing, right? Like, we put so much money and resources and attention into
punitive measures.
Yeah, into prisons, instead of investing in figuring out what the conditions are that
cause
violence.
Yeah. Okay, so surprise, surprise, 6 months after his release, sex workers in Austria began to go missing and their bodies were found murdered by strangulation. On May 20th, the first body was found in the Vienna woods. She died from strangulation of her own tights, and when she was found, she was almost completely decomposed. Her name was Sabine Moitzi, and she was 25. She worked at a bakery and also worked secretly as a sex worker at night. By secretly, I mean she wasn't registered as a sex worker with the Office of Health as sex workers were required to in Vienna. So it's important to note that at this point of time, sex work was actually legal in Vienna and like regulated in this way. But clearly, people's views and beliefs on sex work were still pretty antiquated. And I thought this was important to note, that just because you like decriminalize something or legalize something doesn't make it safer, especially if those individuals are still being viewed as with less value or worth no value from the rest of society. Sabine had a substance problem with heroin and was using sex work to manage her costs. And she went missing on April 16th, 1990, after her friend dropped her off at a train station. And it's suspected that she died that night based on the decomposition of her body on May 20th. A second body was found 3 days later on May 23rd. It was the body of Karen Eroglu, who disappeared on May 7th from the corner she worked on, a few blocks from where Sabine had been last seen. So he could have done it on the same night. She had been beaten and strangled with her leotard, and the same kind of knot was found around her neck that was found on Sabine's neck with her tights. At this point of time, Vienna was considered one of the cleanest and safest cities in the world. It was associated with coffee houses and classical music. And sex worker homicides were no higher than the general population homicides at this time. On Monday, June 3rd, 10 days after Corinne's body was found, a reporter from the Austrian Broadcasting Corporation arrived at police headquarters for an interview with the chief about these murders. So who was this reporter? His name was Jack Unterweger.
Classic.
He said he was producing a story for a current affairs radio show, and that he was a freelance reporter who had been given this assignment because his aunt was a sex worker who was murdered in 1967. Hmm. We don't even know whether this is true. The author of that book, Entering Hades, thinks that it was a lie. He said that he had learned from his aunt about, quote, the lives of prostitutes, and from losing her, he understood what women in the red light district were going through. The previous Friday, he had interviewed a few of them while they stood on their corners. His story was broadcast on June 5th, and it was titled The Fear in the Red Light Milieu. So he was literally reporting on the murders that, spoiler alert, he was committing. Mm-hmm. So the chief of police, his name was Chief Edelbacher, was telling his wife about this, and they were listening to his story on the radio, and his wife was like, oh, this is Jack Unterweger. And he was like, you know him? And she was like, you don't know him?
Okay, what's up with police just, like, not knowing?
Right, like, that happened with the Richard Ramirez,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, they were like, who the fuck is this guy getting beat up in the back of my car?
He went viral. How do you not know who he is? Over the next 6 months, there were several other killings across Austria, all sex workers, all strangled with their bras. There was Brunhild Masser, 39, Heidi Hemmerer, 31, Elfried Schrempf, 35, Sylvia Zagler, 23, Regina Prem, 32. In most cases, their bodies were dumped deep in the woods outside of Vienna or Graz. And he was actually, when it was unknown who it was, he was titled the Vienna Woods Strangler. Regina Prem's husband, Rudolf, actually came forward, said she had grown up in an orphanage. He knew she was a sex worker, and he was a stay-at-home dad. She, with her earnings, had furnished their apartment and playroom, and her husband, Rudolf, stated that she was, quote, an insanely good mother. At 9:45 p.m. on Sunday, April 28, 1991, Rudolf dropped Regina off for an appointment with a regular client, a wine salesman. She usually finished work around 2 a.m. and called Rudolf to pick her up. When she didn't call that morning, he drove to her corner and saw she wasn't there. Massive bummer, and I think it's very cool that this person's husband was very, very, very supportive of her career. Mm-hmm. In September of 1990, so a year before this almost, a Czech sex worker, Blanka Bochkova, was strangled with her own underwear. And very curiously, around the same time, Jack was in Prague researching a magazine article on the city's red light district.
Like, is nobody seeing the connection and similarities to the Margaret Schaefer murder?
Yeah. I think people were, because my next point is that although he was a suspect, there was only circumstantial evidence tying him to these crimes, and there was no witnesses or forensic evidence at this point. He was on the list of suspects for these murders, but he told the police that he valued his freedom and celebrity too much to risk it with new crimes. And his influential supporters in the elite agreed with him, and many Austrians still believe that Unterweger was a victim of class warfare, or a police conspiracy, or an overzealous justice department.
Whoa. I wonder if this is like the world that conservatives imagine liberals want. You know?
Yeah. Where the serial killers are just roaming free.
Roaming free. I mean, they are roaming free.
They are.
And we have the highest incarceration rate, I think, in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We're a world leader.
Yeah. So I'm about to pass it on to Shayna. But on June 10th, 1991, Unterweger appeared again at Edelbarker's office and said he was about to leave for Los Angeles, where he intended to do a story on crime and law enforcement. He said he wanted to meet some police officers and perhaps drive around on patrol, and wondered if Edelbarker had any contacts at the LAPD. And so he was going there to report for an Austrian magazine. It was in this time he was sent to the U.S. to, quote, cover the plight of American prostitutes.
Fucking Jack. The audacity, too. Like, he's so confident.
Yeah. It's like, I'm going to L.A.
Get in touch with
Do you know
some
any police officers that I could ride around with?
Classic inserting himself into the crime scenes.
Yep.
All right. So, on June 11th, he arrives at LAX, which is Los Angeles International Airport. And he's wearing an all-white outfit with snakeskin cowboy boots.
Oh, my God.
And gold chains.
Oh, my God. He's so extra.
He's just doing the most.
Yeah.
I hate him.
He really does think he's so cool when, if you actually look at pictures of him,
he's not.
He looks like a cult leader.
He does. Oh my gosh.
He could be a cult leader based on his personality.
He 100%.
Yeah.
I mean, arguably,
he was
leading some kind of
weird kind of
culty
supporters.
Because they really loved him. They really ate his shit up. And this is where Hotel Cecil comes back in, because this is where he checked into and stayed during his trip to Los Angeles. He told his supervisor at the publication he was working for that he also wanted to go to L.A. to look for his dad, Jack Becker.
Wow.
Yeah. He was trying to reconcile some daddy issues, I guess.
I'm just thinking about how he gave himself the name Jack. And I, one, wonder whether he was trying to link himself to his dad, but also link himself to Jack the Ripper.
Maybe both.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised if it was both. Because his name was Johan.
Yeah. His name was Johan.
I don't get Jack from Johan.
No, me neither.
People also say that they think that he chose the Hotel Cecil because of its relationship to Richard Ramirez, because we know that he stayed there.
Yeah, it was around the same time.
Yeah. Too. Yeah, it was like, what, maybe 5-6 years later?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So they offered to help him try to locate his dad using Stern Magazine's contacts. And Jack learns that they were not able to locate his dad. And Jack takes this really hard. He's super upset. And some people suggest that it's a catalyst for the next set of murders that happen. He kind of goes on a spree, which I'll get into.
So just reminding me of that, like, episode of Hotel where it's, like, all the ghosts of the serial killers having dinner.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, some source said that Jack Unterweger inspired a character that was in Hotel. American Horror Story Hotel.
Yeah.
I
think it was, wasn't it the main character?
Yeah, it was the main character.
Yeah.
Who ends up being like the Ten Commandments killer, mm-hmm, or whatever.
Mm-hmm,
oh,
mm-hmm.
Sorry, spoiler.
Spoiler.
Whatever, again.
It came out several years ago.
It came out a long time ago.
Yeah.
Should have watched it.
It's a great season.
Honestly, it's the best season. I know that we said that already.
Yeah, I think we did. But I mean, it has Lady Gaga in it. The story's great. I think every single character that you meet has mommy issues.
Yeah?
Yeah, that's what I realized when I first watched it. I was like, every time they would introduce a new character, it would end up that they had some kind of mommy issues or were the mommy of the mommy issues. And Lady Gaga is the ultimate mommy in that season.
She is the ultimate mommy. Lady Gaga is so good in it.
Yeah, she
really
is.
She was, like, made for that one character.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's a brilliant season. Would recommend.
Yes. It's on Netflix. Sex, Drugs, and Vampires.
Sex, Drugs, and Vampires. That is definitely a succinct way to describe that season.
Yep.
And it's beautifully shot. Mm-hmm. The cinematography, mm-hmm. the costumes, mm-hmm. the violence even is kind of pretty, which is weird.
Yeah.
They just do a good job.
They do a good job with it.
Pretty violent sounds weird. But if anyone has anyone seen Hannibal? Because I describe that show as like beautifully grotesque.
I haven't seen it.
Okay. Well, you should because it's very good.
Okay.
But the way that
I know
they...
you're into the cannibals. In a... In a curious way, not in a...
I am into the cannibals. I don't...
They intrigue you.
Yeah. Couldn't tell you why.
Yeah.
Just weirdly into cannibals. I'll go down like a...
Cannibal rabbit hole.
Yes. Although I read that Jeffrey Dahmer didn't like to eat people with tattoos because it made their skin taste weird. So take notes.
Take notes. I have tattoos.
Yeah, me too. So... Watch out. Okay. So, as Akshi mentioned, he used his reporting to secure rides along with police. They just, like, let him... Apparently, that was just a thing that journalists could do, is just go on ride-alongs with the police. And he gave them insight into catching killers because he was a crime reporter. And during this time, he's using these ride-alongs as a way to locate areas where sex work was common.
Mm-hmm. And as we know from the previous episodes, the area that Hotel Cecil in was one in which there were a lot of sex workers active,
yeah.
right?
Yep. So he could have chosen that spot for a variety of reasons. Mm-hmm. We also know it was pretty cheap at the time, as yep. we mentioned before. So during this time also, he's like living it up. He goes to the Pride Parade.
What?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
He goes to the Pride Parade, and he made a note to say that he disapproved of the simulated sex acts there, which I just think is really rich.
Okay.
Considering
coming from you.
That he's a serial rapist yeah. and murderer.
Yep.
Okay. And he also went to a festival, Echo Park. So he's, you
he's
know,
living it up.
He's living it up in L.A. In the meantime, he's also picking up sex workers and murdering them. The first one that was noted was 20-year-old Shannon Exley. She worked not too far from the Hotel Cecil, and she was sexually assaulted with a tree branch and strangled with her bra.
Oh, my God. I guess he didn't have access to his steel rod at this point.
I guess. And... There was an article I read that said that she had called her father earlier in the day telling him that she was trying to get her life in order. So I think maybe she was at this time like figuring out her next move.
Yeah.
Sounds like he targeted people in LA at least who were doing survival sex work.
Yeah.
So I don't know. That just made me sad. She was like really young.
Yeah.
A few days after the ride along, on June 28th, he picked up Irene Rodriguez, 33 years old, also assaulted her with a tree branch and strangled her with her bra. Her body was found in a parking lot. Irene had just arrived in LA. She was new there on a Greyhound bus from El Paso, Texas, where she had been living with her common law husband and four children. So on July 3rd, he drives up the hills of Malibu to find Robert Dornhelm, who was a wealthy Austrian filmmaker. And Jack fucking goes to his house, like finds his address, goes to his house. And he's like a high profile guy. He had not been like super well known for his films yet, but he lived across the street from like Cher.
Cher.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like he's going into some like
celebrity filled neighborhood.
Yes.
It's his ego.
Yeah. It's his ego.
And he also considers himself to be a celebrity.
He does.
Yeah.
Oh, my bad. He lived across the street from Madonna, not Cher. Different one name.
Yeah. Still famous.
Big celebrity. An icon. So he wants him to make an English adaptation of Purgatory. That's why he goes to the house. And Dornhelm is, like, reasonably annoyed that he found his home.
Yeah.
But he amuses him and says, like, sure. I'm sure he's really pushy, too. So he's like, sure, let me see it. Jack can tell that he doesn't actually want to work with him and that he just wanted him to leave. So he does. But I think that this was the second catalyst to the next murder.
Does not like to be rejected.
No, he has high rejection sensitivity, which is a symptom of narcissistic personality disorder, which we'll get into later. It's clearly not the only one. There's a lot of things that evoke
ADHD
rejection.
Also has rejection sensitivity. Okay. I have it.
Oh.
I'm working on it. I'm working on it.
Okay. You're wanted and you're not a burden, Akshi.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thanks for the validation.
Yes. So he has extremely high rejection sensitivity and also he has a big ego. And the first thing that happened was they can't find his dad. So whatever outcome he wanted to get out of that.
Didn't happen.
He gets upset. And then the second time where he was, like, super sure that this was going to work out and there was going to be an English adaptation in L.A. with his purgatory story, didn't work out. So
I wonder how Jack's ghost feels about Michael Fassbender playing him in the next movie that's going to come out soon about him. Probably pretty good. Yeah. Kind of gross that, like...
Pretty gross.
Person who's marked as, like, the most attractive man of the year at some point is going to play him.
Yeah. Reminds me of how they casted Zac Efron to play Ted Bundy. Why did they do
that?
What
the fuck?
Like, at least cast someone who's known to be a little creepy, okay?
Yeah. Like, not like High School Musical, teenage heartthrob Zac Efron.
Yeah, what the fuck? Okay. So he leaves... And later that day, he picks up 26-year-old Sherry Booth on Sunset Boulevard, another sex worker, and he drives 30 miles back to Malibu to kill her and assaulted her again with a tree branch and strangled her with her bra. So clearly...
What's going on here?
Clearly Malibu was a site of rage for him, right? Where he, like, didn't have control over the outcome that he was going for. So my take on this is that he took her there to reestablish dominance and control in this place that he had just experienced a rejection that he couldn't handle, was why I think he chose the space.
Yeah.
This happened on July 3rd, and her body was found on July 11th, 1991, by a couple of men and their children. There was a solar eclipse that day, and they came to the secluded peak to get a good view. And her body was half-clothed, decomposing under a laurel shrub, which is just...
Fucked.
At this point, he had struck 3 times in L.A. within a 14-day period. And with the 9 days of cooling off between the first and the second, and 5 days between the second and the third, which I think were the time markers between... getting the news about his dad not being found and then getting the news that no one wants to make a fucking English adaptation of his stupid story.
Purgatory
is super pissed. So after that, he's like, I'm done with LA, and he leaves to go back to Austria. He gets back to Austria and he is interviewed on the radio a few days after his return. So clearly he's still getting attention. He made no mention of the trip, but he did talk about his book Purgatory. And it was not as well received as he had planned. It was old news.
Oh, people don't care about him anymore.
No,
they've moved on.
They've moved on. He was trendy for a time, and they moved on to the next thing, I guess.
It's what happens when you go viral. It only lasts a little bit of time.
Yeah.
And people get over it and bored.
Right. And so now he's realizing he's not continuously interesting. People were wondering why he was only focusing on his early life. Like, everybody knew about his early life. The whole book was about his early life, and it's the only thing he wanted to talk about.
Yeah.
So.
Well, maybe it's because it was something that he fabricated, and so he had control over that story, but he doesn't have control over the rest of the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and his whole rest of his life has been about, like, murdering people, so... Need more time to dream up a story about that. So, okay, at this point, Charlotta, this is where the relative comes in. Charlotta, the stepdaughter of Jack's grandfather, was, like, fucking pissed. that, he was still getting all of this attention. The source that I was listening to said that she tried to ignore the radio interview. When Jack goes to Vehement Valley to celebrate his birthday, where he was going to perform a reading of Purgatory, she saw him sitting at a cafe with a group of women and confronts him.
Whoa! Mm-hmm. Go Charlotta.
Go Charlotta. She was like, why are you saying all these things? They're not true. And he denies he knows who she is.
Wow.
He like pretends he doesn't know
Very
her.
Very suspect.
And she pulls up pics of him and his grandpa from age 2 to 8.
She's like ready.
She is ready. She's like, look, these stories you've told about our grandfather's not true. Which, you know, she was only in the house between... Like, he was still living with the grandfather after she left. So it is possible that he got... It's not impossible that he abused Jack. Like, you know, in some way, shape, or form. But clearly, like, there's some serious embellishing that has been happening. She was like, he did not bring home sex workers and have sex with them in front of you.
Yeah.
Charlotta suggests that he was a really ornery child. Like, he was really, really hard to deal with. And he was manipulative.
What's the kid version of antisocial? Conduct disorder.
Conduct disorder.
Yeah.
Or oppositional defiant disorder.
Yeah.
Which, as we've mentioned, I think, before.
We have.
Yeah. The source that I was listening to was like, maybe after she left, he didn't know how to control Jack and maybe like got aggressive with him.
Yeah.
Because shortly after, he was taken away from his grandfather and put into foster care. And we don't really know why that happened. So something happened.
Yeah.
We just don't know what it is. And it's not Jack's version of the story.
Mm-hmm.
We don't think.
Yeah.
People don't think. And Charlotta definitely doesn't think. She's super pissed about it. So at this point, she's causing a scene. And Jack, like, stands up and leans in and tells her that she should be quiet. Otherwise, something could happen to her. So,
Ooh.
So she backs off. During this time, also, Peter Grolig, a reporter for The Courier, I think, is also a little sus.
There's definitely people who are sus, just like we are, about little old Jack.
There's a lot of people who are like, what the fuck, about Jack, for sure. And Peter was one of those people. And he began to investigate Jack when he was in L.A. and paid attention to Schenner's tip to the police around the beginning of the summer. He noticed that there were parallels between Margaret Schaefer's death and the bodies that had been found in Vienna. He clearly has the same M.O. And lo and behold, on August 4th, the body of Sylvia Zagler, who had disappeared the night of April 8th, was found in the woods 5 miles from Vienna. The body was badly decomposed, and the police said that there was a lack of evidence and kind of threw their hands up. They were like, well, we don't have enough physical evidence to make any ties, basically. And so Peter was like very frustrated with the police at this point because it was clearly so parallel.
Yep.
And on September 1st, 1991, he published an article about the tip tying LA murders to the Vienna murders. They basically did everything but name Jack outright.
Mm-hmm.
A few days later, a teletype arrived at the headquarters, and inspectors in Graz were investigating the murders of 2 sex workers that preceded the Vienna murders, and they were wondering if the Vienna police could assist them. And the Vienna police are like, it can't be Jack.
They're his little boy. It can't be our little boy. He's rehabilitated. He doesn't want to ruin his celebrity by committing crimes.
Nope.
He covers the deaths of sex workers as his job.
So how could he be the reason for the death of sex workers? Makes no sense. Sense no make. Brain no compute. So, they did that. But although Vienna police were like, can't be Jack, Graz police think otherwise and continue to pursue him. Around this time, Jack also visits the officer, Edelbacher, that was mentioned earlier, the police chief, who tells him that he's a suspect. And he was like, why would I do that? I could never dream of going back to prison. I would never do that. And, like, he comes back to Edelbacher with his alibi, and it just doesn't add up. Clearly he wasn't able to come up with anything around the times that the murders were happening. And now Edelbacher is sus.
Yep. probably reading his energy too, and he's like,
What the fuck?
Yeah.
He like goes out of his way to be like, look, I have not an alibi. Me. It's kind of like, you know, when little kids lie.
Yeah.
And they're like, I did not steal the chocolate. Everyone's like, no one asked you if you stole the chocolate.
Yep.
Did you just tell on yourself?
Yeah.
I feel like he does this constantly.
He does.
Yeah. He also says that he couldn't, I don't remember like the exact details, but he had told them that he couldn't get to a place in time because he doesn't drive. And they have footage of him driving. So Edelbacher was like, if he's lying about this, then he's probably lying about all this other stuff. Yeah.
And you didn't mention this, but when he went to LA and he rented a car, he put, you know, you can put whatever kind of name on the license plate, and he put like Jack something on it. It's always so lame when I think that people put their own names on their license plate.
I did see that he did that to all of his cars.
What is wrong with him?
Jack loves Jack.
True.
That's Jack loves what I Jack. Said. Yeah. So Jack is unfazed. He still thinks he's so sly. He's
like, I'm doing so good.
I'm doing so good. Jack do so good. he still continues to work on stories and shit, like business as usual. And around this time, like, this is a few months after, I think around November, he meets 18-year-old Bianca, who lives with a very strict mom. She feels like she doesn't have any control in her life, and she just wants to be free. And Jack really uses this desire for freedom to his advantage. After a few weeks after casually seeing each other, he offers his place to rent to her. To no one's surprise, he became very controlling. He had a very strict regimen. I think also they said that he continued the regimen he was given in prison. So he woke up at the same time. He did the same things because I don't think he knew how to live without that regimen anymore, which, you know, speaks to prisons not being rehabilitative.
He's also in his 40s at this point, and Bianca's 18.
Oh, yeah. Disgusting.
Shaking my head. Disgusting. I'm shaking my head.
And she probably thinks, wow, this older man, like, maybe...
He's a writer. Mm-hmm. He's a journalist. He's traveled.
He must think I'm so mature. I don't know.
He's a groomer.
He groomed her big time. And since, I don't know, she had a really strict mom, so I imagine that her, like, lived experience is pretty limited.
Mm-hmm.
And relationship experience is really limited. Mm-hmm. So all of these red flags, she's not picking up on them.
Yep.
Like the love bombing, the very quickly moving relationship.
Yep.
And she, like, living with him doesn't have any freedom. He, like, doesn't let her leave the house without his permission. Doesn't let her do anything without his permission. And I'm sure he frames this as a way, like, oh, I do this out of love.
I'm trying to protect you.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure he says all that shit.
There's a serial killer out there.
I bet you.
Not in here, out there.
Out there. Yeah. So, but she's smitten with him. She said, like, the consensus on this, like, on the sources that I read was that she would, like, do anything for him. She agrees also, like, to work for an escort company as a host. She didn't know what that meant. And when she realizes that by escort, like, this is a job that Jack is offering to get her. And then when she realizes that he wants her to have sex with people, she backs out and she storms off. She's like, I'm not doing that. You tricked me. So, like, clearly flags are going off for her. And he chases after her and he apologizes. He's like, I'm so sorry. It's a misunderstanding. I'll never do it again. Like, classic cycle of violence.
Yep.
Buyback phase.
Yep.
And they reconcile. And Jack gets her a job as a bartender. And he proposes shortly after. And they've only been together for a few months at this point. So he's really trying to anchor her down.
Mm-hmm.
By January 1992, Graz investigators ramp up their search and show pics of Jack at the red light district to try to see if any sex workers recognized him and had any information about, like, adverse run-ins with him. And actually, a 19-year-old sex worker, Joanna, came forward and said that she'd been picked up in Graz by a man in a BMW with the number plate WJack1.
Wow.
Who had driven her out of town. See, like, he's so
obvious.
He just, yeah. He's not even trying to be sneaky.
No.
He really, really, really believes in his ability to just, like,
get away with shit.
Yes.
Which he did.
People confirmed to him that mm-hmm. he's, like, this beloved person regardless of what he had done. And what he said in his fucking book, like, that is not...
That's not healed writing.
That's not healed writing.
I can't believe all those people ate up his shit so much.
Oh, my God. They really wanted to believe...
Yeah.
I don't know what kind of weird veil that they were under.
Yeah.
That is wild as fuck.
Yeah. I did read the stuff about how it was related to how Nazis used to, you know, oppress, murder writers, artists.
Yeah.
So I'm sure it's related to that, too.
Oh, for sure. They just didn't want any, like any ties at all.
Yeah, yeah.
Any association. And that's, like, not abnormal during genocide, too. Mm-hmm, like, I think there was a genocide in Cambodia where they targeted specifically...
Khmer Rouge.
Yes.
Yeah.
That shit's so fucked up. My coworker went to the...
site.
The site, yeah. Because now they do tours and tell the mm-hmm. history. And mm-hmm. a lot of the stuff was preserved from how they left it.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Horrifying. Anyways, that's a whole
different thing.
Whole different thing. Okay. So this woman, Joanna, says that this man, W. Jack 1, drove her out of town. And she said that he'd restrained her and sexually assaulted her. And then he drove her back to Graz. Gross-ass man. And so this story was a real, I think, a tipping point for the Graz police.
I'm glad that they're taking it seriously.
Right.
Unlike the Viennese police.
Yeah. Well, I hate that she just carried this horrific story with her and didn't come forward with it because I imagine, as a sex worker, people don't believe in rape.
Mm-hmm.
Especially, like, when...
It's just a job risk.
So that sucks. And she's so young, too.
Yeah.
If she's 19 years old now...
She was probably, like, 17, 18 when it happened.
Yeah. So I'm sure he threatened her, too, like, not to say something.
Yep.
So this happened back in 1990, and it's now January 1992. So this assault happened days before the first two Graz social workers. I put SWERS and I read it as social workers. Wow. Okay, it happened in October 1990, days before the first of the two Graz sex workers were murdered.
Mm.
And the press began hounding him for interviews.
Hounding Jack?
Yes, because they knew that he was on the
suspect list.
And through journalist contacts, he learned that the Graz and Vienna police were communicating about him, which gave him... a tip. So he fled to Switzerland with Bianca. The Austrian federal police officer Ernst Geiger was also onto him. He listened to Schenner's tip and Graz police, and so there's another set of eyes on him. Geiger sent all the evidence to the Vienna DA, and of course they said there's not enough evidence. And the Interior Ministry, which I guess is like the federal level entity, didn't agree with them. So they put together a special commission, like an investigative team, across cities to investigate him further, even though Vienna was still saying that...
He's our little boy. It's not him.
And the press learned that the team was pursuing Jack, and they promised to wait to report until February 15th. However... investigators were meeting on February 14th, the same night the Saturday morning papers were released. So they released the February 15th newspapers that evening, and on the front page, the headline said, "Murder series and arrest warrant for Jack Unterweger." And so Jack sees this and he freaks the fuck out, clearly. Around this time also, they go to his apartment. He wasn't there anymore, clearly, because he had gone to Switzerland. And they find a jacket, a red scarf, a pic of him with LAPD. So stupid. Restaurant receipts from LA, a switchblade, and pepper spray. And the switchblade and pepper spray, they noted that he wasn't allowed to have because he had just been released from prison.
Yep.
for a violent crime.
Yep.
And they use the jacket and the red scarf to see if they can pull any forensic evidence from them. And they also called LAPD because they saw that he was chilling with them. He's really just dropping breadcrumbs everywhere.
Yep.
To see if there were any similar crimes. And they were like, holy shit, it's been 8 months since these happened and we haven't seen any connections to these murders anywhere in the U.S. We thought it was just going to be a cold case.
Yep.
And turns out they had the three murders of sex workers that were killed in the same way with the same items.
Being strangled with the same knot.
Mm-hmm. So the murders in Vienna were then connected to the murders in L.A. The scarf ended up being the first bit of, like, actual evidence. Because after running multiple tests, they were able to connect like a hair follicle to Heidi, one of the murdered sex workers. So this was their first bit of evidence. And during this time, I'm just like imagining like a movie where like they're doing all this and at the same time Jack is like in Switzerland freaking out. He confesses to Bianca that he's a killer. And that he needs to leave because he can't go to prison again. Like, imagine being Bianca at this point.
Yeah. She's like, oh, fuck.
Yeah. Also, at this time, I think that he threatens suicide if she doesn't come. Because...
He's so manipulative.
Like, a lot of sources just were like, paint her as some passive participant. I really do think... it's very clear that he's very abusive.
Yeah.
And scary.
Yeah.
And so the threat of violence is very real with him.
Like, especially now he's confessed that he's a murderer as well.
Right. Why would you test that?
Yeah.
Why would you test that?
And I'm sure she's questioning, oh, he's murdered sex workers before and he tried to get me to do that too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and then he also threatened suicide. So I think is a way to guilt her to go to the U.S. And so just wanted to name that because... people were really bashing on Bianca, and I was
she's 18.
She's 18, and I think he really was abusing her.
Yeah.
She's pretty trapped at this point, anyway. Mm-hmm. So he quickly goes to Paris, and from there he takes a flight to Miami.
Miami.
To Miami with Bianca.
So I'll take it back. Some stuff that I had that you missed, Shayna, was... right after the warrant for his arrest was issued, the day after, he actually called Graz headquarters. Oh, he asked to speak to the officer that he cruised around with in September 1990, and he said, "Why are the Graz police persecuting me? They have no evidence. So what is the meaning of this arrest warrant?"
I do remember that. He also called the press, too,
right? Yeah, he did. And then this police officer said it would be better for him if he cooperated, and he said, "No, I won't. I cannot bear going back into a cell, and this news has already destroyed me socially. There's no sense in me staying in Austria." And then he dips to Switzerland with Bianca, and then Paris, and then he takes a flight to Miami. Apparently, Miami was chosen because of Bianca's infatuation with the TV show Miami Vice. So once they got there, he asked Bianca to get a job as a go-go dancer. She got this job as a dancer and was earning money basically to take care of Jack. She even bought him a typewriter while they were there.
Wow.
Yeah. They settled into a routine. They spent the mornings at the beach, afternoons strolling and people watching, window shopping. And while Bianca went to work at night, Unterweger worked on his defense.
He's just living off of all the women in his life.
Literally.
Oh, my God.
He would also call the Austrian media periodically to protest his innocence. A headline in Austria read at this point, "Hell, it's me, the mass murderer." And they were trying to, like, joke about his calls to the press. He also kept in touch with another girlfriend back in Vienna. Her name was Elizabeth. And when he had run out of money and was sleeping on the beach and his life was actually in grave danger because he didn't have his thyroid medication, or at least that's what he told Elizabeth, he asked her, could she send it to him? And could she also send him whatever money she could save together? And clearly Elizabeth was also fucking done with Jack's bullshit. So she called him one day and she told him that her boss at Success Magazine would pay him for a $10,000 exclusive on the run interview. And he really loved that. He said, $10,000 for an interview? Crazy. He wrote that in his diary.
He has a diary. What is this?
So this was a ruse. Elizabeth Schmidt had actually tipped off Geiger and given him a slip of paper that said USA Money Exchange 207 11th Street, Miami Beach. She's wiring the advance today. It'll be there for him to pick up tomorrow. The next day, U.S. Marshal Sean Conboy and his team sat on a hotel terrace on 11th Street. The orders were to watch the USA Money Exchange across the street to see if a European male, 5'6", early 40s, with pale skins and tattoos on his upper arms, arrived. And he did. He arrived with his girlfriend to pick up a wire transfer. And when he was arrested, he sobbed all the way to the courthouse. Oh. Poor baby Jack. And on May 27th, 1992, he was extradited to Austria. The intellectuals who had befriended him were in shock, disbelief, and offered remorse to the public. The writer Humer, who I had mentioned earlier, the talk show host, told The Guardian, "If he was the killer, he would be one of the cases of the century. Statistically, the chance that I would know one of the cases of the century is so unlikely, therefore I think he's not guilty."
Man, the cognitive dissonance is so real with all of these people.
Bianca stood by him, telling one interviewer he couldn't have killed them, they weren't his type. She also observed, "Jack has such beautifully cared for hands. He could be very sweet with those hands. I can't imagine he could have used those hands to kill someone." There's just also some cognitive dissonance because he told her that he was a murderer.
Yeah.
So she's just defending him.
She is. I also wonder what else he's saying. I just wonder what he's saying to her.
Yeah.
I'm sure he went to Miami to make her believe that they moved there for her.
Yeah, because she was the one who picked Miami.
And then dangled it over her head. And I also wonder if he would say things like, "Well, I got away before. What makes you think I can't get away now?"
Yeah.
"And who's going to believe you?"
Yeah.
"And I'm coming for you if, you know?"
Anything
like there,
happens.
There's like a real threat there.
Yeah.
And it's true. He did get away.
Yeah.
So I don't know. People really paint Bianca. Like, I don't fucking know Bianca.
Yeah. I feel for her. She's an 18-year-old who's been just, like, targeted by this fucked up dude. So, yeah.
I just think there's more going on there.
There's a lot probably going on for her. An Austrian writer, Sonia Einstein, actually paid for Jack's correspondence classes and was moved by a poem that he wrote, which actually turned out to be plagiarized from Hermann Hesse, who wrote Siddhartha.
Wow.
Years later, as suspicion grew in her mind, Sonia realized she'd been duped and she wrote to Austria's largest paper, "Jack Unterweger is a shark in the Austrian cultural scene, an agent of destruction that threatens all of society. No one is safe from him." So she was clearly mad that he tricked her.
I would be too.
Yep. So his trial started on April 20th, Hitler's birthday.
Okay.
It was billed the trial of the century. And the investigation file was nearly 20,000 pages long. He was charged with 11 killings, including the three in L.A., a long-distance prosecution that is allowed through Austrian law. Never before in Austrian history had one man been accused on so many counts of murder. And it was three trials in one. It was about murders that took place in Austria, the USA, and Czech Republic. And the trial took place in Graz instead of Vienna because the Vienna police was too cowardly to try its, quote, infamous son. The author Leek, who wrote the Hades book that I mentioned earlier, says, "The idea that the poster boy for rehabilitation cruised around the country strangling hookers, paying for gas, food, and lodging with state subsidies was too embarrassing to contemplate." So lots of cognitive dissonance.
Yeah, I mean, should be embarrassed.
And he, the same author, also explains the differences between the U.S. and Austrian justice systems and drops references to Nietzsche, who was a favorite of Unterweger, Freud, and the classic film noir, The Third Man, and the Nazi persecution of the so-called degenerate artists, which the author believes made, quote, the pendulum swung to the opposite extreme in post-war Vienna, and no one dared call an artist or writer a degenerate, which was what we were talking about earlier. Mm-hmm. So during the trial, witnesses from L.A. and Prague also gave testimony, and so did forensic scientists from Switzerland, Germany, and the U.S. They were trying to find forensic evidence because still at this point, most of the evidence against Jack was circumstantial. They were able to track Jack's car from when he killed Blanka Bochkova, and a Swiss DNA expert testified that the four hairs were Unterweger's, while the other three, within 99.96% certainty, matched Bochkova's genetic fingerprint. Even those convinced of Unterweger's guilt find it perplexing that an 11-year-old car with at least four owners was found in a junkyard with such a conveniently tidy package of evidence. But, you know, there it was. All the evidence was largely circumstantial or inconclusive, but still pointed in Jack's direction. Most damning is that he was present in all of these locations when the murders took place, and he lacked a plausible alibi for any of the 11 murders. Mm-hmm. Jack's closing argument, which he was allowed to, I guess, have an own argument during his trial. I don't know what's up with them representing themselves. But he says, I implore you, even if you are disgusted by his way of life, to think whether that's enough to say he doesn't deserve to live a life of freedom. And then regarding the hairs and the DNA evidence, he says, I can't deal with this scientifically, not at all. I just don't get this DNA stuff. My brain developed gene bumps when I was studying. I don't know what the fuck he's saying. Anyway, he says further, I was a rat, a primitive criminal who grunted rather than talked, an inveterate liar. The prosecutor is right. I consumed women rather than loved them, but I'm counting on my acquittal because I'm not the culprit. Your decision will affect not only me, but the real murderer because he's laughing up his sleeve.
What?
He's literally just saying bullshit because he knows he's about to get charged.
Is he trying to appear like he's not mentally sound?
Maybe. Because that's what he did the first time, too.
Right, and it worked for him.
Yep. So during the deliberation, it was actually thunderstorming outside, and it took 9 hours. Two voted for acquittal on all counts. A majority chose acquittal in two cases where there was little evidence, and a majority voted for conviction for 9 other cases. It's very likely that he killed even more. For example, there's the case of Maritza Horwat in March of 1973, which is suspected to be his first victim. She was a 25-year-old Croatian woman who went missing after going into Salzburg to spend some time with her friends. Her body was found in a lake by hikers. She was beaten and naked from the waist down, and her wrists were bound with a necktie, and her ankles were bound with her tights, and her mouth had been gagged. Detective Schenner spent months looking for her killer, tracing the origins of the necktie, which he found was purchased in March at a shop in Vienna. He noticed a connection between Maritza Horwat and Margaret Schaefer's murder and questioned Jack while he was incarcerated for Margaret Schaefer's murder, but he denied it, even though he had been released from prison in the same town the tie was bought from just months before. There was no forensic or witness evidence, so no charges were ever brought for the death of Maritza Horwat. Jack's lawyer, Hans Jürgen Lioffer, said, the jury said he was guilty, and I believe it was a fair trial. So I'm going to pass it to you, Shayna, to talk a little bit about our friend Jack and what's going on in his little brain.
Okay. So a psychologist at his trial said, this is a direct quote, that he's a sexually sadistic psychopath with narcissistic and histrionic tendencies, prone to fits of rage and anger. He is an incorrigible perpetrator. So I thought I'd break down some of what's being implied there. So I'm going to start with narcissistic personality disorder, which is what they say that they think he's had for most of his life. Like other personality disorders, NPD occurs on a spectrum and involves a range of symptoms. The DSM-5, which is the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, which if people don't know is a go-to book for mental health disorders. So the DSM-5 lists 9 traits that help identify NPD, but only 5 are needed for a diagnosis. Common symptoms of NPD include grandiose fantasies and behavior, such as preoccupation with thoughts of personal success, power, and attractiveness, or sex appeal. He really thought he was, like,
that's a check
hot for stuff. Jack. Yeah. With his, like, all-white suit.
Yeah. His, like, cowboy boots. His chains. Boots, his tattoos.
Ugh. Give me a break. Jack. Okay, so another symptom is little or no empathy for other people's emotions or feelings, a significant need for attention, admiration, and recognition, an inflated sense of self-importance, such as a tendency to exaggerate personal talent or achievements.
Like when he went to that dude's house and asked him to make a movie?
A belief in personal specialness and superiority, a sense of entitlement, a tendency to take advantage of others or exploit people for personal gain, arrogant or conceited behavior and attitudes, a tendency to envy those and believe others envy them. So these are common symptoms, and again, you only need...
He has all of them.
He does. He only needs 5 for the diagnosis. He has, like, all of them.
Yeah.
This webpage, which is linked in the sources just like everything else, notes that people with NPD often have trouble dealing with change. They may feel depressed or humiliated when they feel slighted, which would account for the extreme response when things didn't go his way, have a hard time with insecurity and vulnerability, and react angrily when others don't seem to regard them with the admiration that they want. Another source notes that people with NPD may act superior and confident, but this is usually a defense mechanism to an often fragile sense of self and lack of self-esteem.
Mm-hmm.
They crave attention and praise, yet are unable to form close relationships. So this, like, childlike behavior, there really is a petulant child inside of Jack throwing a fit all the time.
Yeah,
is how I imagine that.
He's very insecure.
He's extremely insecure. No one needs to act like that if they're secure.
No.
Also, no one acts like that when they've got strong relationships. Mm-hmm, they feel like...
Yeah. Connected.
Genuine connection, belonging. When you have those things, you don't act like this.
Yeah. But it's weird because after he was released from prison, there was all these people who are, like, kind of offering him
whatever. They weren't friends. He had no friends.
Yeah.
And he had no family.
Yeah.
And the only family that he did have, he feels abandoned him.
Yeah. Yep.
Apparently abused him and hate him.
Yep.
You know, like, nobody likes him.
Yep.
Nobody loves him.
Jack loves Jack.
Jack loves Jack. But maybe Jack doesn't actually love Jack.
Yeah.
Jack just wants to love Jack so bad that he's acting this way.
Yep, yep. Good insight.
This condition also tends to involve difficulty managing emotions and behavioral responses to stress. The causes of NPD aren't well understood. However, inherited genetic defects are thought to be responsible for many cases of NPD, whatever the fuck that means.
Yeah.
That was, like, direct quote from this, like, Healthline site, which I don't know what that means.
Yeah, I don't know what that means.
Contributing environmental factors may include child abuse or neglect, or the opposite end of that, excessive parental pampering. So, like, the absence of boundaries. Unrealistic expectations from parents. It's like a triad of extremes. They list cultural influences, and they don't...
What does that mean?
They don't expand on what that means, and I'm not sure what they mean, but the way I take it is, like, I was just thinking about, like, in Vienna, it sounds like there's, like, a really rich culture of misogyny, and I think all of that really bolstered his narcissism and sense of entitlement, because...
They freaking had a movement to get him out of prison. He had a life sentence.
Right. Despite all of these things.
Yeah.
So when I hear cultural influences, I'm like, that's what I'm thinking of.
Yeah.
Like, the norms that exacerbate behaviors that already exist.
Yep.
Like, that allow for Gary to get away with what he got away with.
Yep.
And shit like that.
And Ted.
And Ted. Wow. Truly. Truly.
We always talk about Ted.
I know. Ted gets way too much attention.
Yeah, he really does.
Okay. So this brings me to malignant narcissistic personality disorder, which professionals in the psychology field say that they think that his personality moved from general narcissistic personality disorder into malignant narcissistic personality disorder, especially through his time getting released from prison. And some say it's the most dangerous subtype of NPD. It's not recognized as a formal diagnosis, but it's a way to conceptualize a specific set of personality traits that accompany narcissistic tendencies. So according to the Campbell's Psychiatric Dictionary, malignant narcissism combines characteristics of NPD, but also antisocial personality disorder, aggression and sadism, either towards others, self, or both, and paranoia. Aggression is, again, not a diagnosis, but a way to describe behavior. And they list three different types of aggression. They list hostile aggression, which is behavior specifically aimed at injuring or destroying someone or something. Instrumental aggression, which is an aggressive act that relates to a specific goal, such as smashing a car window to steal a wallet. And affective aggression, which refers to the behavior usually directed at a person or object that triggered an emotion. Mm. It may also be redirected if it isn't possible to target the actual source. And they list punching a wall instead of punching another person is an example of affective aggression, particularly when the action involves a desire to cause damage.
Or murdering a sex worker after you've been told that your movie's not going to be made.
Right, or you can't find your dad.
Yep.
When you're feeling abandoned.
Yep.
I also did a little search in JSTOR because I was wondering what else was available on malignant narcissism. Nice. And I found this article that is dated. It's like from the early 90s, so keep that in mind. They describe a malignant narcissist as someone with severe superego deficiencies. So which, if people don't know what is meant by superego, what I get from that is like it's Freudian. So Freud said that, like, you know, we have the id, which is like our primal selves, and we have the superego, which is like our moral conscience, and then our ego, which is the integration of both. So basically, it's a way of saying that they don't have a moral conscience. Like,
mm-hmm.
So an individual with such psychological characteristics may have some advantages in rising to power, and his behavior may be an effective response to some real-life factors. But once he has consolidated his position, his reality testing capacities diminish. Fantasies held in check, when his power is limited, are apt to become his guides to action. As a consequence, his behavior becomes more erratic. He runs into difficulties in meeting his goals, and his paranoid defenses become more exaggerated, which we see with a lot of serial killers. Mm-hmm. But this article was not about serial killers. It was about tyrants like Hitler and Stalin. And I couldn't stop thinking about Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, he also 100% has narcissistic PD.
I mean,
and when he gained the presidency, a lot of psychologists came out to be like, he has narcissistic PD.
Yeah.
Like, very clearly.
Like, textbook.
Yeah.
And perhaps this person might even say that he's a malignant narcissist.
Yep.
Which was, it was just interesting to make the connection because mm-hmm. also I think Jack reminds me of Donald Trump too. Maybe that's why he makes me so mad.
Yeah.
He really does.
He does. He does.
Ugh, my God. I hate that guy.
Yep. I hate that guy.
I hate that guy. But when they were talking about consolidating power, I also was thinking about, like, you know, murdering sex workers was a way of him to consolidate power. And the ultimate consolidation of power was when he was dismissed, but also gained notoriety and celebrity from his stupid book that was published.
Yep.
Like, he really garnered all of this power and control that he was craving, which I think really, like, escalated all of these other symptoms that were coming up mm-hmm. in relationship to his, like, narcissistic personality disorder.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. They also break down sadism, which I'll get into later. Both of us were like, it's really problematic the way that psychology is historically and currently pathologizes sadism in general, because it perpetuates stigma against people who participate in BDSM. But the way that they describe sadism in in this source. Sadism is taking pleasure in humiliating someone or causing them pain. Sadism itself is not a mental health diagnosis, nor is it always sexual. People with sadistic tendencies may enjoy hurting others, enjoy watching others experience pain, derive sexual excitement from seeing others in pain, spend a lot of time fantasizing about hurting other people, even if they don't actually do so, want to hurt others when irritated or angry, enjoy humiliating others, especially in public, tend towards aggressive actions or behave in controlling or domineering ways, which are all things that Jack did. Some psych professionals suggest that this sadistic behavior helps set MPD and malignant narcissism apart. And narcissism also often involves self-centered pursuit of desires and goals, but people with NPD might still sometimes show remorse or regret for hurting others in the process, where consistently people who are deemed to have malignant narcissism don't show remorse, which is where I think the antisocial personality disorder stuff comes in. And then they also listed sexual sadism disorder, which again, I think the language around it is really problematic. Like, sexual sadism in general is different than sexual sadism disorder.
Gotcha.
But I think even conflating the words adds to
stigma.
Totally.
Yeah.
This idea, which is tied to so many other ways that we categorize everything in one pot and just demonize an entire group of people based on false notions of sexual deviance or whatever, which is fucked up. And it wasn't that long ago that we institutionalized people based on arbitrary diagnoses, quote unquote paraphilic disorders, which I am not going to go into because it's a whole nother fucking thing. It's gonna take me forever.
Look it up.
They describe sexual sadism disorder as sexual sadism that causes significant distress or significant functional impairment or is acted on with a non-consenting person.
Okay.
So I guess the key words are significant distress, significant functional impairment, or someone who is a fucking rapist, basically.
Yep.
So DSM criteria says that in order for someone to qualify for this, that patients have repeatedly and intensely aroused by the physical or psychological suffering of another person. Arousal is expressed in fantasies, intense urges, or behaviors. Patients have acted on their urges with a non-consenting person, i.e. they rape, or these fantasies or urges cause significant distress or impair functioning at work, in social situations, or other important areas. And they also say that this condition has to be present for more than 6 months, 6 months or more. I don't know how they landed on this, but that's how they landed on it. So those are all of the subcategories of what makes someone a malignant narcissist, which is what they say that Jack was. And also they say that a lot of tyrants are, which makes a lot of sense. But I saw this as an opportunity to address stigma against BDSM, because I think there's a lot of misconception about it. BDSM stands for bondage, dominance, sadism, and masochism. While psychologists would call him a sexual sadist, with a disorder, he used violence in a way that took away people's autonomy and their lives. And he enjoyed causing suffering. And BDSM is not about that at all. In fact, Corinne Werder wrote a piece for Go Mag, which is an online publication, and she shares how BDSM can be a healing practice for survivors of sexual trauma. So she describes BDSM as a sexual practice about power dynamics or experiencing pain as pleasure. It's interdisciplinary, and therefore the actual practice varies for everyone in the community. That's because kinks come in many forms: suspension play, role play, physical restriction, power exchange, administration of pain, spanking, and age play, just to list a few. She names that the current BDSM 4C consent model is based around caring, communication, consent, and caution. And she shares other people's stories, but hers as well, about how BDSM can be a tool for healing and empowerment after traumatic things have happened to you. And says, though psychologists have historically pathologized kinky behavior as sexual sadism and sexual masochism disorders, there is research that shows that people who practice BDSM are actually less neurotic, more extroverted, more open to new experiences, more conscientious, less rejection sensitive, and have higher subjective well-being than non-kinky people. A similar U.S. study found BDSM-identified couples reported less stress as well as increased intimacy following play. And
wow.
Yeah, isn't that wild?
Yeah.
That's super cool. And she says that while not every trauma survivor will find BDSM healing, it has been proven to work really, really well for some people. And then she makes parallels to the steps of setting up like a BDSM scene to recovering from trauma in a therapeutic space with like skill building all the way down to integration. She like compared that with like negotiating, play, and then aftercare, which I thought was cool the way that she tied those in.
Yep.
Which we'll list this in our sources so you can read it yourself. She ends by saying, after experiencing a traumatic event where you felt utterly powerless, hopeless, feared death would result, or felt invaded, taking back control over your body can be extremely empowering. It's an act of reclamation. Your body becomes a medium of healing through these cathartic scenes. Some rape survivors even choose to play out a scene similar to their rape, but with a different end result. They walk away feeling a huge sense of release and healing, which makes so much sense because trauma can play in a loop in your brain until you break that cycle with new or different information. Which also reminded me, like, parallels to art therapy.
Yeah, I was thinking about Theater of the Oppressed when you were talking about that.
Yeah.
And changing the outcomes of specific situations.
Yeah. So
very cool.
Yeah. And also a similar sentiment from an article from the online publication Them, from the perspective of a dominant. Their name is Daemonum X. And they say, at its core, BDSM forces us to share our desires, to deeply negotiate those desires, to plan for how we want to engage with them, and even what happens after. For myself and many others who had traumatic sexual histories, normalizing communication around desire and consent is incredibly healing. So, yeah, I just wanted to share that.
Thanks for sharing.
Mm-hmm.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
And I have seen things like articles about that before, but really cool to hear about it and also research that's been done. I'm a fan.
I'm a fan too. I also, yeah, I was like, I'm going to use this opportunity.
Yeah.
To like demystify
BDSM.
BDSM. Because there's such like a stigma and misunderstanding or lack of any information about what BDSM actually looks like, people confuse abusive relationships. So I used to work with, I do DV work, have done DV work, and I've spoke with multiple people who maybe did BDSM in their sexual lives, and they were sharing that it was spilling into their daily lives. And it took a long time to get to that point where they actually shared that with me, because there was so much shame around sharing that they were like into BDSM with this person who was abusing them.
Mm-hmm.
And also these were people who were like new to BDSM. So they didn't know. And they like were taking the lead of the person who was abusing them and like using that to their advantage. And I typically ask, sounds like what you're saying is like you're okay with it in this situation, but you're not okay with it in this situation. Am I hearing you right? And they were like, yeah. Kind of working through like what's missing here is consent.
Yep.
And the steps of negotiating and consenting and then aftercare, like this whole process of making sure that everything that happened was like everybody who was participating was on board is missing from abusive relationships, and that was the differentiator. I was just sitting here like, man, if there wasn't so much fucking stigma about BDSM and like shame about talking about sex in general, then all of these people wouldn't be so like scared to tell me about, you know, the reality of like what was going on.
Yeah.
Also, I want to note that some people who are into BDSM have BDSM relationships where like that role is turned on all the time, but like the key thing is that both people are like wanting to do that.
Yep.
And there are safe words.
Yeah.
You know,
like, and aftercare. It's very important.
And fucking boundaries.
Yeah.
Like that's the whole point, is that your boundaries aren't being crossed in a way that makes you feel uncomfortable or harmed.
Yeah.
And that's not true in abusive relationships. Abusive relationships are all about ignoring boundaries.
Yep.
Consent is non-existent in abusive relationships. So I just wanted to name that you can be in an abusive relationship that has BDSM, and it's not to conflate BDSM with abuse, you know? But I think like if we just took more time to like understand.
Yeah.
I think BDSM, when practiced in its all of its like intended ways, is like the healthiest shit I've ever seen.
It's in the Kama Sutras.
Is it?
Yeah.
Wow.
So
do you want to share about that?
I don't know that much about it. right now. I'd have to look into it. But I know that aspects of BDSM are in the Kama Sutras, which were written, like, centuries ago. So, yeah.
Okay.
They're throwing it back to me?
I am throwing it back to you. That's what I got.
So, let's round out Jack's story. After he was charged and convicted, he was put in prison days after, during a routine check at 3 a.m. on June 29, 1994, he was found lying quietly on his cot. Another 40 minutes later, he was found dead. He was found hanging in his cell at 3:40 a.m. from a noose he'd made using a thin metal wire and the drawstring of his jogging pants. The knot he used was the same one found on all the victims that he strangled.
Wow, how poetic.
Yeah, we didn't mention this at all, but a lot of the articles and what he was mentioned as is the poet of death. Very romanticizing him, but mm-hmm. Yeah. His lawyer told the press, "Every day he said to me, 'If I'm found guilty, I'll kill myself.'" His lawyer didn't believe him, but after the verdict, he looked completely deflated, like a sausage that had lost its stuffing, is what he said.
Oh, okay. Not a perfect time to laugh, but that's a really funny analogy. Why?
Yeah.
It also reminds me of Donald Trump moping around after he realized he lost.
Yeah, it does. Yep. He does look a lot more deflated. One writer observed, "For a while it was chic to listen to the convicted murderer who had turned good, but not many of those who supported him then like to talk about it now." So Jack's story rounded up pretty neatly with his little knot, but mm-hmm. It's unsurprising based on the fact that he had narcissistic PD that he died by suicide after he was convicted, especially because he really didn't want to go back to prison.
Right. Well, Hitler did the same thing.
He did. He did.
To avoid consequence.
He did.
And to preserve his reality, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
One of Unterweger's most vocal supporters, Günter Nennig, postulated some blame should be affixed onto the Viennese intellectuals for breaking into this life and then abandoning him. His lawyer also said maybe on the night he killed himself, he saw his victims coming at him. But now I've said too much, is what he...
Oh, okay.
I don't know what the fuck that means. Maybe he was just trying to get some attention, this lawyer, but that's some ghosty shit.
That is some ghosty shit. I hope he's haunted.
Yeah.
I hope he's in a place where he's perpetually haunted.
I hope he's in purgatory. And to try to end this fucked up ass, really wild story, on a positive note, I wanted to just highlight some books that have been written by other folks who have been incarcerated, because honestly, don't fucking go out there and read Purgatory. Nobody needs to read that book. Let's not give him any more attention. I still can't believe Michael Fassbender is going to play him in a movie. But I'm going to highlight some books written by other incarcerated folks. To start off with, Letter from Birmingham by Martin Luther King Jr., was written while he was in prison for participating in civil rights demonstrations in the 1950s, and it was a letter that was written in response to someone telling him he should remove himself from the campaign for civil rights. Another book, Conversations with Myself by Nelson Mandela, which is many of his writings, journal entries, and letters composed during his 27 years of incarceration, and he was incarcerated for standing up against South African apartheid and human rights violations against Black South Africans. Inside This Place, Not Of It, compiled by Aylett Waldman and Michelle Alexander, is narratives from women's prisons in the U.S., current and former incarcerated women. Stolen Lives by Malika Ufkir. Malika Ufkir, her mother and siblings were imprisoned for a crime committed by her father, who attempted an assassination of the King of Morocco. She and her family were detained for over 15 years after the execution of their father. Bad by James Carr, born and raised in Compton and spent most of his life in prison. This book talks about how difficult it is to escape systemic violence and incarceration for Black folks in America. Memoirs from Women's Prison by Nawal El-Sadawi, who's a feminist author and was arrested for crimes against the state by the Egyptian government. Continued advocacy from within prison and refused to submit to the silencing that the prison sentences intended for her. Letters and Papers from Prison by Dietrich Bonhoeffer. A Lutheran theologian was arrested and imprisoned and executed by the Nazis in 1945 because of his role in a plot to assassinate Hitler. This book is a collection of his reflections, political resistance against tyranny and genocide, and was written while he was incarcerated and before he was executed. And last, The Life and Adventure of a Haunted Convict by Austin Reed, who is a Black American. The book was published in 2016, 150 years after it was written.
Wow.
Yeah. And it was written while he was serving time in New York State Prison from the 1830s through the 1850s. So just wanted to highlight that Jack is not by any means the only person who has written books and created art while incarcerated. And there's many folks who have done the same and whose work should be highlighted because they were not offered redemption because they wrote books.
Right.
And some of them were executed. So there's that.
But as you said earlier, they're a threat to the status quo.
Exactly.
And Jack wasn't.
As we can see from these brief summaries of these books, most if not all of these people were incarcerated because of their threat to the state.
Hmm.
And their activism.
Yeah, I don't know if we were talking about this before we recorded, or but I just guess coming back to my point that like any legislative reforms are incomplete and kind of just for optics if you're not addressing the root issues. Like if you're still in a misogynistic culture, then all of the legislation is going to be executed through the lens of misogyny.
Yep.
Same with racism, same with homophobia, transphobia, any type of oppression you could think of.
Yep.
You know, so like as long as the prize that we got our eyes on is just switching up
policy
to forward a political agenda and using people as pawns for that political agenda still doesn't change the conditions that we're living in.
Yep. Yeah, we need to shift our collective consciousness
for
and
real.
Move to communities of care if that's what we want to do. And
okay.
On that wonderful note, thus ends our Hotel Cecil series.
Yes. Can you believe
all this fucking shit happened in that hotel?
Wow. And this was just three stories, you
yeah.
know? Like,
yeah.
We gave you a laundry list of
yeah.
all the shit that happened.
In the Elisa Lam episode.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Which, if you haven't listened to the other ones, you should go back because all of the references that we make a lot more sense.
Yeah.
If you start from the top.
Yep. A lethal location series.
A lethal location series. Also, like, as I mentioned at the beginning, we go into a lot more depth around, like, how sex workers face heightened levels of violence with or without the addition of, like, a serial killer.
Yep.
And we share a report by the Young Women's Empowerment Project. We also share a survivor story at the end if you're interested
yep.
in reviewing that.
And it's in the Asshole Aquarius episode, which is our second episode.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
About another fucked up person who targeted sex workers.
Right, Gary.
Yeah. Gary, indeed. Fuck Gary.
Fuck you, Gary.
And that's it for now.
That's all. Okay, so if you like what you heard, rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Check out our Patreon at patreon.com/unpackingtheerie, or you can find it on our Instagram at unpackingtheerie in our link tree.
Follow us on Facebook. Follow us on Instagram at unpackingtheerie.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have thoughts or just want to say hey, you can email us or DM us. Our email is unpackingtheerie@gmail.com.
Yes. And for the first 20 patrons, we're not at 20 yet. We're at 7. We're writing handwritten cards as a thank you. You also get access to our close friends on Instagram if that is at all appealing to you. Just
thanks for supporting us, everyone.
Yeah, thank you so much. See you next time.
See ya. Bye.
Okay. catch you on the flippity flip.